Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah with Lion and Lamb Ministries. Welcome to our program. We are going through the Gospel of Matthew, well into the study. And in fact, we are in Matthew chapter 24. In our last program, we addressed how Yeshua is answering the questions of the disciples about what were the signs of the times, what were the signs of the end of the age, what would be the signs associated with his coming. There really were three questions there. One of them had to do with the stones being knocked over. That was at the siege of Jerusalem. As we approached the end times, the final generation, and then finally, he begins to speak directly to the events of the Great Tribulation, which is the time of distress, as the world has never seen before, the final 3.5 years. In this particular portion, he's going to move into the dynamics going on in the Great Tribulation, as well as what will be the end result once the tribulation is over with. We are specifically in Matthew chapter 24, and we are beginning at verse 26 in this program. If therefore they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth, or behold, he's in the inner room, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Might be a little bit encryptic when you first look at this, but he's answering the question where in the Great Tribulation, somebody might say, oh, the Messiah's already returned. He's over here. No, everybody's going to see the Messiah when he returns, and it will be a rather significant event. He refers to it as lightning coming from the east and flashing to the west. The coming of the Son of Man will be. And we're talking about when the world sees him, they'll be seeing him at the day of the Lord. You and I, as believers, will see the sign of the Son of Man coming, and then we will be part of the resurrection and the rapture. But he's speaking of the world and what will transpire for them. Now, he also says something rather interesting here with regard to this. Verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the powers of heaven will be shaken. The Great Tribulation prophesied length is 1290 days, according to the prophet Daniel. But then in that same prophecy in Daniel chapter 12, he said, blessed is he who sees the 1335th day. So what's the difference between 1290 and 1335? Well, it's a 45-day period, and as Yeshua is referring to here, he's talking about a set of days immediately after the tribulation. He's talking about that 45-day period, and he says that immediately after the tribulation, the darkness which had been on the earth in the Great Trib for the previous 5 months or so it comes to a conclusion, and we begin to see the sign of the Son of Man. So let me back this up just a little bit so that we've kind of got it straight. There is a prophecy in Daniel called the vision of the evenings and mornings. And how would you have evenings and mornings and then you don't have evenings and mornings? Well, evenings and mornings are associated with the sunrise and the sunset. But if you're in darkness, and the world is in darkness, then there's no sunrise and sunset. And if you take that prophecy and you say, okay, this is when the darkness begins, it's approximately 5 months before this time. And at the same time, in the book of Revelation, when it's talking about the fifth trumpet, it talks about an asteroid, a heavenly body, striking the earth into the abyss of the earth, bringing forth clouds of debris and bringing darkness on the earth. Isaiah chapter 60 talks about the final period of the indignation in which there's darkness over the peoples. So the final 5 months of the Great Tribulation is the world is plunged into darkness. There's no sunrise, no sunset. And here Yeshua is saying, now immediately after the days of tribulation, that will still be happening. However, it's about to depart because the brightness of the Son of Man will be coming, and that will be in stark contrast to the previous 5 months of darkness. So we're talking about He's specifically talking about the days immediately after the tribulation, that 45-day period. Now, let me just do a quick summary for you. We believe that's when the Lord will fulfill the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and also tabernacles in that time frame, which are the feasts that prophesy of the second coming or the work of restoration that the Messiah will do. All right, so it says, verse 30, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn and will come and see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Now, we are told in Luke that when we see this, we're to lift our heads, for our redemption is drawing near, whereas others, are those that are unbelievers, will go into the holes of the earth and try to hide, and as Revelation says, will beg for the mountains to fall upon them and crush them, because who can stand in the day of the wrath of the Lamb? That's part of the sixth seal. So he goes on to say here further, verse 31, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. This is the resurrection and the rapture, and this will be the future fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets. And trumpets will be occurring in those 45 days period immediately after it. Now, he's going to shift gears. He's kind of laid out some of the hard facts about what leads up to the Great Tribulation, what is the Great Tribulation, what happens immediately after the Great Tribulation. But now he wants to give some instruction to us as to how do we deal with all of this. And so he's going to give a couple of parables here. And he begins with this, verse 32. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. If you'll recall, in the last program, we talked about the Great Tribulation and when it starts. And Yeshua made reference to the season of winter. He was talking about those that were in Judea, that they have to flee at the start of the Great Tribulation, and it would be in the season of winter. And now here, he's talking about he's right at the door, he's about to return, and he makes a reference to a parable about summer. Well, winter is the opposite of summer. It's a half year apart. So the Great Tribulation begins in a winter and will conclude 3.5 years later at the turn of the year at the fall holidays. By the way, the turn of a Hebrew year is at trumpets. And so he talks about that will be the completion of the 3.5 years of all of these events. And he's telling us that his return will be associated with summer, and it's right at the end of summer that the Feast of Trumpets takes place. So he goes a little bit further here, and keying off of that, he says, verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation shall not pass away and all things take place. For many years, people have taken that verse and said, well, how long is a generation? How long will a generation last? And part of the speculation of trying to measure out when is the end of the ages is to look at various generations and the length of generations. There's been contention put forward that a generation is 30 years, 33 years. Some say, no, it's 70 years, and others saving other dimensions. I don't know that we can specifically try to put a number to a generation for this. It seems to me what Yeshua is really saying is there's a generation that will see the Great Tribulation and all of these things leading up to the Great Tribulation, and that generation will not pass away until all of the end of the age events have taken place. So if we go back to the start of the Great Tribulation, all of the signs, the beginning of sorrows, the birth pangs, and so forth, it's saying that that generation will see those things, see the Great Tribulation, and see his coming. That one generation, all of those things will transpire within that period of time. And it's not split up over a whole bunch of years. That one generation is appointed unto that task. If you go back to Moses in the portion called Nitzavim, this is the portion that's taught just before the Feast of Trumpets, Moses says, I'm not talking to all the people that are standing here today. So the question is, well, who are you talking to, Moses? Well, he speaks to a future generation. And he speaks to a generation that will see Israel go into the land, disobey the Lord, be scattered into the nations, and then being gathered back from the nations. And he talks about that generation. And that's essentially what we have. You could make an argument that when Israel became a nation in 1948, that may have been a milestone or a benchmark for the start of the generation. We see the return of the Jewish people. The land of Israel has been reestablished. Here in recent days, we've seen the United States finally move their embassy to Jerusalem. We see Jerusalem now becoming the capital. Of course, there's one more event that we're looking for, the events that start the Great Tribulation. That is the Jews getting a piece of the Temple Mount, rebuilding the altar, and the prophecies of the abomination of desolation taking place. As I speak at this moment, we've not yet seen that, but those are things that we're anticipating, and we believe that will fall within the confines of this generation. So that's the reason why we pay close attention to the events that are taking place in Israel. Now, he goes on to say something rather interesting. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. A lot of people have used this to say, well, nobody can take these prophecies and understand them to the point of being able to project forward. And this is the verse that they use against anybody who tries to project a future date. While I agree that the people in the past who've put dates out are having a little bit of foolishness, I do not agree that this is a verse that proves that. This phrase where he says, no man knows the day or the hour, is a Hebrew idiom for the Feast of Trumpets. Because trumpets comes on the first day of the month, we don't know exactly when it is. We can calculate it, but until you observe it from Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, you don't know if, in fact, it is the first day of Tishri. And trumpets is the only holiday that falls on the first of the month. And so that's where we get the expression with regard to exactly when the Feast of Trumpets is. No man knows the day or the hour. And so when he just got through talking about the resurrection, and we believe the resurrection takes place at a future Feast of Trumpets, it only is fitting that he would make reference to the Feast of Trumpets at that very moment. But there's another aspect of this that we also should consider. And he says, refers to, no one knows this, not even the angels and so forth. This is also a point of what we call honor and distinction. I'll give you a quick example. My father's name was Charles William Judah. I never once ever called him that by that name in his person. He was Dad, and I would answer questions as to his name, but I would not overtly speak that. And even if I knew that we were going to do something and he had said we were going to do something, I wouldn't usurp his position and announce that we're doing something without deferring to him when he had made the decision. This is what I see Yeshua doing with his father. Even at this moment, even though he's talking about his return, he's still deferring to his heavenly father and say, he's the one that knows. He's the one that will make the decision. Now, I think Yeshua does know when he's coming back. I think the Holy Spirit knows when he's coming back. But I think the honor is given to the Father to make that pronouncement, to make that to be known. And I think there's two aspects of this, and I think that's a very important one. That is a marker of true spiritual humility. And you've seen situations where we've had a president in the United States and maybe one of the men in the administration has spoken ahead of the president to announce something and didn't wait for the president to make the announcement. That's considered to be very terrible protocol. It usually refers to the person as having an ego. And it's only appropriate that Yeshua would not announce his own return, but rather would defer to his heavenly father and let him say that and to get everybody to follow along with that. All right. So verse 37, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. So he's making a reference back to Noah. And as we can all imagine the story of Noah, he's out there building the ark. I'm sure there were people coming up and saying, Noah, what are you doing? Well, there's going to be a flood, and God told me to build this ark of these dimensions and so forth. I'm sure the people looked at Noah like he was nuts, because it appeared to them he was just building an animal hotel. And it wasn't, they couldn't understand the concept. And the key operative word here is understanding. They had the knowledge. I mean, Noah had told them what was going to happen. They had the knowledge of what it was, but they didn't understand it. They couldn't come to terms with it, couldn't process it to the point of believing in it or acting on it. That's what Yeshua is saying about these days. We have lots of people who believe in the coming of the Son of Man. But do they understand the prophecies, and can they translate that into preparation? Can they translate that into getting ready for the coming of the Son of Man? Or are they like those back before the flood, where they continue on with their lives as normal and keep putting off the idea that he's not coming? Yeshua is going to talk about this thing, because apparently this is going to be a major issue in the end of days, just before the Lord comes and we have the great tribulation. There are many brethren who have heard the prophecies of the coming, and if you ask them and say, do you believe in it? Sure. They've heard about the great tribulation. Sure, I believe in that. You know, but it's not going to happen to me. And what they're doing is they're putting themselves in the position of where they have the knowledge of the prophecy, but they don't understand the prophecy. And he says this is going to be a problem. And he's going to go through some other parables here where he's going to talk about the master returning and the slaves not getting ready for the master return and other things like that. So let's proceed into what Yeshua, how he addresses this, the lack of understanding on the part of the people at the end of the age. And this is not only unbelievers, but this also applies to believers as well. Verse 41, two women were grinding. Excuse me, let me start at verse 40. Then there shall be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day the Lord is coming. The issue of a lot of people try to use this as a reference to the pre-tribulation rapture, the sudden catching up and translation of the saints. That's really not what this is talking about. If you go to Luke, you will find out that those that were taken to judgment, and the others were left. The world is going to be suddenly, rapidly taken into judgment by God, and we who remain are the remnant of that. And I know that a lot of people will twist that around, but if you go to Luke, he'll help. This is a parallel passage. It clarifies this quite a bit. He goes on to say that you still don't know which day the Lord is coming. You know, the book of Hebrews says that we can see the day approaching, but we don't know the exact day. And if you don't understand the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, and Tabernacles, and you don't understand how the Messiah came and fulfilled the spring feast, and at his second coming, he's going to come and fulfill the fall feast, then you're going to be very confused about what is this prophetic scenario, how does it really work? I've shared this before. If you and I had been living in the time that Yeshua came the first time, and we wanted to talk about the great work that the Messiah was going to do, the work of redemption, and the key events of his life, which, by the way, there's coming up in this gospel, his being arrested, him being tried, him being executed, dying, and then being resurrected. If you had wanted to understand that prophecy, how the Messiah will do the work of redemption, then there's one particular biblical feast that you would want to study intensely. That would have been the Passover. The Passover is the Feast of Redemption. And this is the one that the Messiah and the other gospel writers spend so much time focusing on. What did Yeshua do at the Passover? What did he say there? Because he was fulfilling the Passover. He was the Lamb of God that would be slain so that we might be passed from death to life. An incredible picture of redemption that's been given to us. But now in these days, where he's already come and done the work of redemption, but now he's going to come and do the work of restoration, he's going to return, he's going to be the king of the earth, and we're going to dwell with him in his kingdom, what biblical holiday should we focus in on the most now? And the answer is tabernacles, the last feast. The first one was the first feast. This one is the last feast. Why? Well, because tabernacles has a lot to say about how the saints are going to be delivered out of the great tribulation and what we're going to be doing when we first get to the kingdom. Whereas Passover spoke to what was the sacrifice of the Messiah and how that would be our covering, whereas this speaks to how do we get delivered and saved out of the days of the great tribulation. Because we're going to dwell in tents and booths and huts in a temporary structure, just like our ancestors did when they left Egypt on their journey to the Promised Land. We are all on a journey to the Promised Land, and we need to regard this world as temporary. That, you know, like the true meaning of the word Hebrew, I'm not from here, I'm from across the river. I'm on a journey to the Promised Land. And we are true Hebrews in that we recognize this is Egypt. This is trials and tribulations. We're leaving here, and we're going to go on a journey to the Promised Land. We're going to get to the Promised Land, and that's where the kingdom will be. Well, Tabernacles illustrates all of those themes, and we actually participate for 8 days in that process of dwelling in tents for it. So he's pointing out the fact that people don't seem to get it about when he's coming. They can't see the day approaching correctly. They don't understand the undergirding themes, the prophetic scenario with this, because they have not yet learned what Moses taught with regard to the coming of the Messiah. Therefore, they have less than all of the information available. And if you have less than all of the information that's available, I can assure you that your understanding is not going to be accurate. You have to accept all of the prophecies, and then you develop understanding from that with the aid of the Holy Spirit to do that with. All right, so let's continue. Verse 43, but be sure of this. If the head of the house had known at what time the night the thief was coming, he would have been on alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you too be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour which you do not think he will. Again, another one is a reference back to the Feast of Trumpets. He's going to be coming and fulfilling the feasts. Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour which he does not know, and he shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and the gnashing of the teeth. Let me put this in focus for you, what Yeshua is essentially saying. As we come to the end of the age, we are seeing, in fact, a lot of prophetic signs of things that are taking place. All of them speak to the end of the age. All of them speak to the beginning of the Great Tribulation, and with it resulting the Messiah returns at the end of it. Now, a lot of people see these signs and they're alarmed by it, and we try to assure them just continue to wait on the Lord. You know, the Lord knows what He's doing. We don't know if this is the exact time, but boy, this certainly suggests that it is. So let's pay attention and watch and so forth. But then we also have other people that look at the same signs. They say, oh, he's not coming back for another 10 years. Or he's not coming back for another 5 years. That's foolishness. That is terrible. The Lord expects us to have a sense of anticipation about His coming. He does not give us the idea that we are supposed to kick back and say, well, He hasn't come for a long time, so He's probably not going to come for a long time. That's what we would call ignoring everything that's in front of you. Now, I, for the last 25 or so years, have been paying close attention. And every time I've seen something, like a watchman on the wall, that I saw something that is noteworthy, that fits into the prophetic scenario, I have spoken to it. I remember the days when the Temple Mount faithful was only 7 Jews. And now the whole nation is interested in having the Temple Mount and having an altar operating on the Temple Mount. Believe me, less than 25 years ago, that was not a common thing. But when I saw the Temple Mount faithful first organizing and their interest in doing that, I reported that. And I said, brethren, this is the kind of thing that will lead to an altar being put on the Temple Mount. Now, this alone is not going to do it, but we're moving in the trend. We're moving in the direction of a very important part of this prophetic scenario. About 10 years ago, there was a big, huge announcement in Israel that they were gathering stones from the Dead Sea area, and they were preparing to get all the materials ready to build the altar with. And in fact, those materials are being stored in East Jerusalem as we speak. Again, I said, well, those are the stones being gathered. See, it's trending toward something that we should be paying close attention to. In the midst of all of those trends taking place, there were still other people say, oh, no, it ain't going to happen. That's what Yeshua is talking about. You be real careful about, as things begin to unfold, of standing up like a disobedient servant and saying, oh, the master's not going to come. I can go party hardy and do whatever I want to do. That would be a huge mistake in the faith. It is very clear that the Lord has given us all these prophetic things to get us to trust and believe in Him. And part of the preparation is to learn how to trust and believe in Him and be faced with the possibility of His coming. So now let's move to chapter 25. He's going to continue with some of these same thoughts about this. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, 5 were prudent. But when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. But the prudent took oil in flasks along with their lamps. Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight, there was a shout, behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the prudent, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the prudent answered and saying, no, there will not be enough for us. You too go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves. And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came. Those who were ready went with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. And later the other virgins also came, saying, Lord, Lord, open up for us. But he answered and said, truly I said to you, I do not know you. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. This is a simple parable that talks about those who prepare versus those who don't prepare. We have a lot of people who, while they see the things that are happening even in this present day, and they all speak to the suggestion that the Lord's getting ready to come back and we're coming to the end of the age, they don't do anything to prepare. They just kind of take it in stride, you know, and whereas others are taking steps and asking the question, what do I need to do to prepare? And of course, one of the biggest preparation things is to believe the Lord. get into the point where you listen to what the Lord says and believe what He says. Because if you don't have that oil, which is a symbol of the Holy Spirit, and you have not acquired that relationship with the Lord, when all of this begins to hit, and you're shaky about whether or not you believe the Lord, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in serious trouble. And it's really a simple case of preparing versus those who do not prepare. And the number one preparation is not stuff. The number one preparation is the preparing of your heart to trust the Lord. And if you're not anticipating the coming of the Lord, then you're not preparing your heart. You're saying, hey, the present status quo is adequate. I don't need to prepare. And that would be the mistake. Now, he's going to go on further. And he says in verse 14, for it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted the possessions to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on the journey. And immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with him and gained 5 more talents. And the one who had received 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. And the one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. I have gained 5 more. And his master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of my master. And the one also who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you've entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more talents. And his master said, well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one who had received 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground, and see, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow, and you gather where, and I gather where I have scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has more shall be given, and he shall have an abundance, but from the one who does not have, even that which he does not have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into outer darkness, and in the place where there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Here, again, another thing about what are you doing in preparing for the master to come back? 2 examples where they went and took what God had given to them and they invested it toward with the anticipation of the coming back of the master. But the third one, he didn't invest. He did not make any additional effort to increase, if you will, the profit of the kingdom. And those that are attentive to the coming of the master, they are interested in increasing the profit of the kingdom. They work toward that goal. They don't just sit on whatever the Lord has given to them. Again, another principle of preparation for the coming of the Lord. He goes now to verse 31. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and then all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate from them one and another, and as the shepherd separates sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. That's what we call investing in heavenly things. What are the heavenly things that are going to make it in the kingdom? People. So when you invest your life in other people to encourage them in the Lord, that's an investment toward the kingdom. Doing something else is something else. And he says to me, naked, you clothed me. I was sick. You visited. I was in prison. You came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, When did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give it to you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will say also to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you did not invite me in naked. You did not clothe me, sick and in prison, you did not visit me. Then they themselves also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick or in prison, did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, the righteous into eternal fire. Essentially, what the Lord is saying, that preparing for the coming of the king is, one, there has to be a sense of anticipation about him coming. You cannot dismiss the prophecies and the signs of the times. And then he goes further to say, how you treat others, you must prepare for this. Well, how do we prepare? He says, well, if you are increasing the kingdom, and by the increase of the kingdom is how many people are in there. And if you're increasing the kingdom and getting it so that more people are part of that kingdom that will be coming, that is the work that you're supposed to be about. But if you're not doing that work, then you really didn't believe in the coming of the Master at all. And those that believe in the coming of the Master, they are about the business of trying to help others come into the kingdom for it. He uses those as examples. And because here's the lesson, we know the end of the age is coming. The Messiah has promised that he will return. We know there will be a time of distress as the world has never seen before. We know it's going to be a very difficult time of the great tribulation. We see all of these events building even in our day today, where it looks like the beginning of sorrows. It looks like the birth pangs. It looks like the things that Yeshua said that would lead us up to the tribulation. Now, the key event is to see that altar shut down, the abomination of desolation. We're anticipating, we're looking for it, because we know when it happens, then there's a very specific prophetic scenario for it. So here we are, and what are we doing to prepare for the coming of the Lord? Are we paying attention to the prophetic signs? Are we interpreting and understanding them correctly? Are we anticipating certain key prophecies like what Daniel said that would be the start of it? Do we understand the prophecies that will happen during the Great Tribulation, what will lead to the coming of the Son of Man? For it, about the final indignation being those 5 months of darkness. Are we anticipating all of those and understanding them so that we can spiritually prepare to trust the Lord when we are in the midst of Great Tribulation? And then he says, this whole thing comes down to, really the final judgment on us comes down to, are you really a servant of the Master, and do you really believe what the Master says? And he uses several different comparisons, you know, to try to illustrate this for it. And quite honestly, my friends, that's where we are today. Where we're at right now today is these parables are very applicable to us. Are we wise and getting more oil for our lamp? Are we wise and serving faithfully the Master? Or are we slouching off, goofing off, and not doing anything? Are we really in a mind to increase the profit of the kingdom? Or are we just burying whatever God gave us and we'll just give it back to him when he shows up? Those are very serious questions to be asked of us, and that we should weigh them and make good answer to those questions. All right, so now we're going to shift gears, and in chapter 26, we're now going to move to the specific events having to do with the arrest and the trial and the condemnation of Yeshua as the Messiah. chapter 26 and verse 1. And it came about that when Yeshua had finished all these words, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming and the Son of Man is to be delivered up for crucifixion. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And they plotted together to seize Yeshua by stealth and kill him. But they were saying, not during the festival, lest a riot occur among the people. Now when Yeshua was in Bethany at the home of Simeon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume, and she poured it over his head as he reclined at the table. But the disciples were indignant when they saw this, and they said, 'Why this waste? For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor.' But Yeshua, aware of this, said to them, 'Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For the poor you have and always will, but you do not always have me. For when she poured the perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, that this woman has done shall be spoken of in memory of her.'" These two events tie together. Yeshua is telling the disciples, "Hey, we're going to go here at the Passover. I'm going to be arrested and I'm going to be killed." You know, it's almost like the disciples are hearing this and it just doesn't register. And it further is evidence that they just don't get it yet when this woman comes up and anoints him with this perfume. And he sees it as something being very special done for him to anoint his body for what's going to be happening. They don't correlate that. They think, "Oh, this is a valuable substance. We could sell that. We could take the money. We could use it for a far greater thing." Well, Yeshua ties the two together, and he says, "You're not getting it about what is happening with me and what's going to be happening with me." And I like this phrase that he says right at the end. "Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done shall also be spoken of in memory of her." The truth of the matter is, your adoration of God is at the forefront of your spiritual life. You can go around doing all kinds of good deeds for other people, but that is not what is the measure of your spiritual walk and your spiritual life before God. What really is the measure of them is, what is your relationship with the Lord? Do you love the Lord and fulfill the greatest commandment? And then as a result, then love your neighbor? Or do you have those two reversed? Oh, I'm going to love my neighbor first, and then I'll get around to God later. And Yeshua is really putting in it focus, because quite honestly, the disciples are still not yet getting this. They're still, even after all this much time that he spent with them and so forth, and he's foretelling them what's going to happen, they just can't quite process it yet. And so he's still going through this process for it. Verse 14, "Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What are you willing to give me to deliver him up to you?' And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver, and from then on he began looking for a good opportunity to betray him." Now, what's interesting here is, why in the world did Judas do that? Judas was the treasurer of the disciples. He was the one who managed the money. And so you remember this most recent thing about, "Oh, you should have taken the perfume and sold it. We would have had more money." There is a good possibility that Judas may have been tipping the till, and that he may have been kind of, you know, embezzling some of the funds off. And he saw a missed opportunity there. And so he's like, that's what motivates him. You know, how much money can I get? So he goes to the chief priest and says, "Hey, what are you willing to give me?" His focus is on the love of money, not on the love of God. And so the love of money, I think, love of money was the temptation that came to him. And so they weighed out 30 pieces of silver. Interestingly enough, in the law, 30 pieces of silver is the price of a female sacrifice. And so he was valued at the level of the bride, the feminine gender. He was, his value is equated to the bride or to the feminine gender. And that's thematically very consistent because that's who he's going to die for. He's not going to die for himself. He's going to die for his bride. Let's go on further here. Verse 17. Now on the first day of unleavened, that should be translated, now at the beginning of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Yeshua saying, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" Let me make sure we got the sequence. If you go to Leviticus 23, here's what you're going to read. Passover is on the 14th day of Nisan. Feast of Unleavened Bread begins on the 15th and goes through the 21st. So there's one day for Passover and then 7 days for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In those days, because you eat unleavened bread on the Passover as well, they called the whole thing the Days of Unleavened or the Feast of Unleavened. They meld the two together because they're all eating the same common bread for both of those events. So the start of this is the Passover. So when he says, now on the beginning of the first unleavened bread, where do you want us to do that? Then he says, where do you want us to prepare the Passover? Now, if you're trying to prepare the Passover, it's not Passover yet, so it's not the first day. So that's the reason why the first day of unleavened phrase there in verse 17 is not the proper translation. It wasn't the first day of unleavened. It was the day before the Passover, and the disciples are going to go prepare the Passover so that they can have it. But it's not the first day of unleavened bread yet. That's a little bit of a twist on that. And by the way, this is one of the areas where the Jews for Judaism will chew Christians up, because this is paradoxical the way the translators have put it together. But it's a simple correction. Now, at the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened, in other words, that whole holiday period, at the beginning of it, then the disciples came and said, where do you want us to prepare the Passover? That makes perfect sense for it. So let's continue on. Verse 18, and he said, go into the city to a certain man, and they say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I am to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. And the disciples did as Yeshua had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Now, if you remember back some time ago, there was an incident before Yeshua entered the city where the disciples were going and find the donkey, and the master has need of your donkey. This is the second incident in which that something is already kind of understood or prearranged, unless Yeshua knows about it, and the disciples are simply being dispatched to carry it out. By the way, when you get into the business of serving the Lord, a lot of times you don't know really what the plan is, but you'll go carry it out, and suddenly you just go, oh, the Lord orchestrated that. The Lord set those steps in motion for me to go and do that. And most spiritual people, they look back on their life and they realize how active the Lord was in their life of ordering their steps so that they would go where they went and meet the people that they met and to have the discussions that they had. So continue on now. Now, when the evening came, and we're talking about now the Passover evening, he was reclining at the table with the 12 disciples, and they were eating. Wait a minute. Before I go further, I got to cover something. This room that he was told that was being prepared in the other Gospels and so forth, they refer to it as the upper room. So what does that mean? The special room. It's now my time. I need to use that. He lets them use it to hold the Passover there in Jerusalem. Where's this upper room, and what does that mean? This room still exists to this day. You go to Jerusalem, and you go near the Zion Gate, and you're going to be at the tomb of King David. There's a room built over the top of King David's tomb, and it's referred to as the upper room. So when Yeshua is having Passover with his disciples, he's joining with them to have it, they're right over the top of the tomb of King David. Why would the Messiah and his disciples want to eat the Passover at that particular location? What's the significance of that? King David is the one who got us the covenant for the Messiah, that the Messiah would be the son of David. Here's the son of David, Yeshua of Nazareth, over the foundation of King David, doing the work of redemption for all of Israel. As far as I'm concerned, that is utterly profound and has been understated by most biblical teachers, in my opinion. And I wanted to make sure that you understood the significance of this. That was a very, very special place. And by the way, when you go in Jerusalem and you visit, you will discover it's a very, very special place. That a lot of people don't realize the significance of it. Now let me start again with verse 20. Now when the evening had come, he was reclining at the table with the 12 disciples. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And being grieved, deeply grieved, each one began to say, "Surely not I, Lord." And he answered and he said, "He who dips his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man is to go, just as is written of him. But woe to that man to be by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." And Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, "Surely it is not I, Rabbi." And he said, "You've said it yourself." The dipping thing is a very well-known part of the Passover Seder. There's a moment before the meal where you take matzah, unleavened bread, and you dip it into a bitter herb, like a horseradish sauce. And then you eat just that. And it's a remembrance of how Pharaoh oppressed the children of Israel before they left Egypt, and that they ate unleavened bread when they left. So it's a reminder of the telling of the story. It's also a reminder of a story of betrayal. And it was the sign that Yeshua used to show to the disciples, it's Judas who dips with me in the bitter herbs. And then when Judas says, "Well, surely it's not me," he said, "You've already said it yourself. You've already said it." And that's when he now leaves the Passover Seder to go to the priests to then plan to identify him for his arrest. And Yeshua continues eating the Passover there with him. So when we come now to the next program, we're going to take up our study from verse 26, talk more about what Yeshua will share at the Passover, and then the events of the crucifixion and what will happen after the crucifixion. So shalom to all of you, and we'll see you in the next program.